This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
What's next for New Orleans? Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Bush said yesterday that New Orleans is making progress, but he ignored angry protests over the city's latest plans for renewal. Mayor Ray Nagin's commission to bring New Orleans back would give Katrina victims just 4 months to prove they can rebuild devastated neighborhoods or lose their property. On To the Point, does that mean the Ninth Ward and other poor black areas will never be reconstructed? Will New Orleans have to make concessions to nature, regardless of the social or political consequences? On Reporter's Notebook, later on, what's wrong with the Medicare drug program? First up, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To the Point. President Bush says there's been progress in New Orleans, but some Katrina victims say reconstruction plans mean the end of the city they've known and loved. On To the Point, we'll hear both sides and ask if the demands of nature will trump those of politics. On Reporter's Notebook, can the president's Medicare drug program be fixed before his next speech on the State of the Union? First, this news update. Angela Merkel visited the White House today for the first time as Chancellor of Germany. Both she and President Bush want to repair the relationship that went sour with former Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder's opposition to the war in Iraq. But the new chancellor and the president made no secret of their disagreement over the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay. Would the president shut it down?
Guantanamo is a necessary part of protecting the American people. And so long as the war on terror goes on, so long as there's a threat, we will inevitably need to hold people that would do ourselves harm in a system that in which people be treated humanely and in which ultimately there is going to be a end, which is a legal system.
What we need to address is how we further want to proceed. We need to, for example, find a reform of the international law in this respect, and I think the United Nations is indeed a good forum to do that. But I think that's part of a permanent dialogue between our two countries.
That second voice was that of a translator. Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Richard, always good to talk with you.
Warren, good to be with you.
Certainly permanent dialogue, to use the chancellor's phrase, was what was emphasized today. How important is this relationship?
Well, until Iraq, the American-German relationship was the single most important transatlantic piece of any of the European nations. And I apologize here to my British friends, but it just critical through the Cold War. And what we really saw through the 90s after Germany unified, and especially with Iraq, was this rupture. Now, the president is aware of the need to repair it, both for political reasons back home, because he's been attacked for it, but also diplomatically too, because if he can move Germany into a camp that is closer to Britain and America, then it does change European politics and diplomacy.
So that's because Germany is such a major factor in Europe itself?
It's the biggest economy. It has huge weight inside Europe, and it's a kind of swing vote. It can get pulled towards France and Russia, or it can get pulled towards Britain. If they can keep it in the American camp, then there's a huge amount they can do in terms of moving a European opinion.
The meeting today between the president and the chancellor went on longer than it was expected to go. The president said that he told everybody else to leave the room, and they were just in there together. It appears they had a very intense exchange, not just about Guantanamo Bay, but about a lot of other things as well.
Yeah, and some of it was personal. The president was clearly fascinated by the chancellor's upbringing in formerly communist East Germany. It's a sign of both how this president operates and how the relationship with Schroeder broke down, which is very much a personal thing. The president likes leaders that he can trust and that he gets a personal bond with. All politics are personal, as the saying goes, but with President Bush, all diplomacy is personal. And he was trying to find out, I think, whether he could trust Merkel, and especially whether he could avoid the problem he had with Schroeder. That's what he thought. that Schroeder didn't follow through on his word, and in fact went back on his word, specifically on Iraq.
Richard Wolff, again, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek. Of course, the president said today he wished former Chancellor Schroeder well and had kind words for him.
He did, and President Bush, in spite of his public image for some people, he can be very gracious. And, you know, I think in the end he decided that it was better not to have an open slanging match with Schroeder. But he's obviously gracious about former leaders.
The major thing they talked about today, I suppose, was Iran, and they do seem to have agreed on that and on the need to take the matter of nuclear development to the United Nations Security Council. He also joked, though, about what they had in common by the fact that neither one of them had won a big victory.
Yeah, and this is important, not just as a moment to lighten the occasion, but Merkel was a great hope for conservatives inside the administration, especially the vice president's office, that not only would she tilt Germany towards America, but that she was going to be an especially conservative leader in Germany. In fact, because of her narrow victory, she has had to build a coalition with people who are left of center, and her rhetoric, especially on Guantanamo Bay, reflects that. So the joke was funny, but also got to some of the problems they now face with Merkel and her government.
What do you think will be the next major issue they have to deal with at the same time?
Well, Iran is important, and it was striking that Merkel was as robust in her comments about Iran as President Bush was. This is a very difficult situation. The Germans, along with the French and the British, have been taking a lead on this. They're all frustrated with it. And, you know, going to the Security Council and pressing for sanctions is serious stuff, but it's especially serious for people trading with Iran. And in that case, it's really the European countries who are going to bear the brunt of this.
All right. Much more to come, obviously. Richard Wolff, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Anytime.
Senior White House correspondent, Newsweek magazine. In a moment, what's next for New Orleans on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, we're not only back with To the Point. Mayor Ray Nagin says he likes his commission's plan to rebuild New Orleans by giving residents 4 months to demonstrate that their neighborhoods can be saved. But some opponents say the poor black people who give the city its character would be the ones to lose their property. The New Orleans Times-Picayune says the most controversial question is whether the city's footprint should be made smaller to reflect a population expected to reach only half its pre-Katrina number. Reed Kroloff is dean of architecture at Tulane University. He helped draw the plan for the mayor's Bring New Orleans Back commission. Dean Kroloff, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Is it going to be necessary for New Orleans to get smaller?
Well, we'd have to have a crystal ball to answer that correctly. But it is likely that New Orleans is going to be a considerably smaller city for some time. Not permanently, but for some time. It may be permanent. That's the part we don't have the crystal ball for.
What about this issue, so controversial now since it was unveiled just a couple of days ago, that residents will have 4 months to demonstrate that they can revitalize their neighborhoods or have to sell their property, perhaps have it seized by eminent domain? What's the theory behind that?
Well, as with any plan as complex as this, not all of the parts have become clear to everybody as they were written in the report. What people heard was a summary. Actually, what's going to happen is an intensive 4-month planning exercise with the people in each neighborhood so that they can come to their own conclusions about what the appropriate action would be for their neighborhood. It may be to stay where they are. It may be to go somewhere else. There's no preconception in any part of town that one neighborhood is more or less viable than another at the moment. It's more an attempt to try and take a pause, wait for the important data that we must have in order to rebuild, and then move forward from that position of information.
What about the idea of having a moratorium on rebuilding until this process can take place?
The idea was not so much to be a punitive kind of action. The idea there was to give us a breather. People are starting to build in areas where FEMA has not released the new flood data for that area, which means that they're taking an enormous gamble, because if FEMA says, well, actually, that's 4 feet higher there than you thought it was before, all of that money has gone into the ground wasted. And what we're asking people to do is at least give us the opportunity to bring them the information that's absolutely essential for them to begin the rebuilding process.
The president yesterday said that the federal government will rebuild the levees and make them stronger. He did not, though, commit to the idea of rebuilding for a Category 5 storm. How important is that, particularly for restoring neighborhoods like the Ninth Ward that are virtually below sea level?
I think it's critically important, but what's more important is to understand that it doesn't necessarily mean Category 5 levees. What it means is a protection system in general as a part of a larger strategy that can handle a Category 5 storm. That might mean higher levees. That might mean locks and gates. That might mean sort of amphibious activities in the lake. There are many ways to look at that. What it means is we need a system that can handle a Category 5 storm, much like they have in Holland.
Reid Kroloff, once again, Dean of Tulane University's School of Architecture, one of those devising the commission on rebuilding New Orleans. Mark Morial is a former mayor of New Orleans, now president of the National Urban League. And, Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you. Good afternoon.
You have been very critical of this program. Why is it?
The plan, as initially envisioned, is a redlining plan. It writes off important neighborhoods. It doesn't support the principle that everyone has a right to return. It exacerbates the wedge that exists between people. And as such, it should not be supported. I feel very, very strongly that the guiding principles of any recovery ought to be the right to return and the right to rebuild, and that everyone ought to have an equal right to do so. This plan, as initially announced, does not do that. It adds great insult by saying to people, you've got to prove that your neighborhood is viable. It places a burden on private property owners to prove that their neighborhood is viable, or they could be subjected to eminent domain by some sort of all-powerful rebuilding authority. And that's why wide cross-sections of people, not only in New Orleans, but around the country, have been, very critical and objectionable to this plan.
Just before you came on the program, Reid Kroloff, whom we spoke to earlier and who's still on the program, said that the plan has not been adequately understood, that in fact what it does is start a planning exercise that will allow people in all the neighborhoods to reach their own conclusions. He says there's no preconception about whether one or another neighborhood is more or less likely to survive, and I wonder if that makes any difference to you.
No, I think that those features were added after the groundswell of criticism that occurred late last week as the plan. It puts the cart before the horse. All of those sorts of things, including neighborhood people, could have been started back in October, back in November. What the plan does is it places the burden on neighborhoods and private property owners and says, you can't rebuild. We're not going to give you a building permit for the next 4 months. We're not going to turn on the power for the next 4 months. And if you don't prove to us that your neighborhood is viable, then the all-powerful new Crescent City Rebuilding Authority can walk in and take your land by eminent domain. There's a principle here. There are people who've lost everything. In some cases, everything that their families have accumulated through a series of generations. There's got to be a great deal of sensitivity. There's got to be a fundamental commitment to every single citizen having the right to return and the right to rebuild. And the plan ought to embrace that principle and embrace that feature as a fundamental principle.
Let me go back to Reed Krolov. What about it, Mr. Krolov? Have, in fact, the kinds of qualifiers that you mentioned earlier been added after the fact? What about the right of all residents to return? Should that be guaranteed?
Well, first of all, the mayor is just simply wrong. If he's read the report, he would see that there is no redlining anywhere in the report. In fact, it goes a great deal to a great length in explaining that all through the program. Second, nothing was added about that. I've been working on this report for weeks, and the basic principles of this report have been in it for a long period before. It had nothing to do with a response to the public perception of this plan, other than that an original trial balloon that was floated by Joe Cannizzaro that said people could move anywhere for 3 years and we'll see what happens was shot down. That wasn't the plan. That was a comment from Mr. Cannizzaro at that time when we were at the very beginning of the planning process. So I think the mayor is just simply incorrect on that. Now, whether or not people have a right to return, of course people have a right to return. Absolutely. What we're suggesting is that if a plan is done correctly, we're going to try and guarantee that they're returning to something that would be good for them, so that they are not rebuilding on land that has great toxicity, or they are not rebuilding in an area where they're the only person for blocks around and would likely be for years and years. And we are not, and they are not, rebuilding in a neighborhood where they're going to be told just 2 or 3 months from now by the federal government, you will never be able to get flood insurance for your property if you build there. This is an attempt to see that the citizens of this community are widely protected, and I just flatly reject any assertion that this is a redlining exercise or a land grab. That's simply preposterous, and I'm surprised that a former mayor would suggest something like that.
Mr. Morial, your response.
I'm suggesting it because, indeed, it is true. I'm suggesting it because if you read between the lines on the plan, so much of this plan has been driven by from the very beginning by this notion of a smaller footprint, by this notion that certain neighborhoods do not deserve to be rebuilt. And to shift the burden to private property owners, to shift the burden of viability to neighborhoods in the community is exactly why people from Lakeview to Gentilly to New Orleans East to the Ninth Ward have vigorously criticized this plan.
Well, Mr. Morial, what about this point that if, in fact, people are allowed to rebuild in a place where the federal government later says they won't have insurance, or where there's toxic land, or where they're the only people there because nobody else can join them, is that right? Is that just?
It's their property, and they have a right to rebuild it, or the government has some obligations if they're going to prevent people from rebuilding their land. Let me say this to you. I'm a native New Orleanian. And there are virtually very few sections of New Orleans that have not, in some case during history, experienced flooding. Whether it was the 1978 flood, which was from a severe rain event, the 1995 flood from a severe rain event, the 1965 Hurricane Betsy, all of the region is indeed in the very same boat and could be under any set of circumstances. At Hurricane Katrina, been 20, 30, 40 miles to the west, been the West Bank of New Orleans, the West Bank of Jefferson Parish, parts of Metairie and the East Bank of Jefferson could have experienced flooding. And that has to be understood, that the idea that, quote, some areas are more prone to flooding than other has to be tempered by the fundamental reality that most of southeastern Louisiana is below sea level. To different extents, yes, maybe a deviation of 10 to 12 feet, but every section is certainly underwater. Now, I led the city and have represented people in the city and now hold a very important position as head of a civil rights organization. And this plan is not going to gain the support that it needs in the Congress of the United States on a national level because it does not embrace the principle that everyone has a right to return.
Mr. Krolov, back to you. How does it embrace the right to return? You said that everybody ought to have that opportunity. How can you persuade the people in Congress, especially those concerned about civil rights and the issues raised by Mark Morial, that you have, in fact, considered the objections he raises?
Well, we have considered them, and let me say that the mayor brings up a number of very good points, and someone who ran the city as long as he has and lived there his whole life clearly has an intimate knowledge that that can be applied here. So I would hope that over time, people like the mayor who have this kind of knowledge, rather than simply criticizing a plan, might offer positive suggestions for how it could be improved. This is a process, not a product. Secondly, the plan says in the very, very beginning that everyone has a right to return. It says it flat on paper. There is no one here trying to limit the rights of people to return. Again, I'll come back to this over and over. We are simply trying to give people an opportunity to learn the greatest amount of information about how to strengthen their neighborhoods, how to build better neighborhoods. Remember, a lot of New Orleans, close to 35,000 homes, for instance, in this city, were already derelict before this storm. Those are not healthy neighborhoods. And we're trying to create a plan that enables people to live anywhere in this city where we can support those the minimum service provision to that and create healthy, vibrant neighborhoods.
Mr. Morial, we're going to lose you in a minute, so let me give you an opportunity to respond. Wait a minute. What about the idea of a positive alternative to what the commission and Mr. Kroloff are saying?
I think there are many people who would like to be involved. There are people at the national level who would like to be part of the discussion. I think to a closed extent, there's been a closed group, a small group of people who've been driving this plan. They need to shine the light. They need to open the doors. They need to quit this whole process of seeing dissent as something that's bad and something that's wrong. You're not, by challenging dissent, going to convince people that the plan is good. The burden is on the commission. The burden is on the commission. They took that responsibility. I think what they've got to do is talk to people at the national and also locally who feel like they've been meaningfully closed out of the process to participate in the discussion and the debate about the future of the city. When I returned to the city, it was shocking to me that in New Orleans East, where people were having church services in a church that had no lights, being powered by a generator, that there was no power turned back on. It was shocking to me that those people that had contractors ready to work, indeed, and this may not be the responsibility of the commission, but you've got to create an environment and create a climate and create an opportunity for people who have the wherewithal, who have the money, who have a property that they want to rebuild.
Okay. Mr. Mayor, we're going to continue this conversation in a moment, but I know you need to leave us before we go to our break. I just want to ask you one question. You've been the mayor of New Orleans. Are you going to run for that office again?
Oh, no. I am. Had a great career. My father served as mayor. I served as mayor. We contributed a lot. People supported us strongly. I'm president of the National Urban League, and I think that this issue of the recovery of New Orleans is important to New Orleans, but it's important to the nation, and it's important to all of us who care about people, who care about urban areas, who care about cities. And that's why I think you're going to see a lot more voices at the national level weigh in, because after all, at the end of the day, the taxpayers of the United States, not just of New Orleans and Louisiana, have to fund this recovery plan,
okay,
which they should. It just needs to be a good, inclusive plan.
Mark Morial, a former mayor of New Orleans, now president of the National Urban League. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We'll come back in a moment, continue this conversation with Reid Kroloff, the dean of Tulane University's School of Architecture, and others. On Reporter's Notebook a little later, what's wrong with the president's Medicare drug program? A lot of states are having problems with it. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about the proposal of the Bring New Orleans Back Commission for rebuilding New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, described by Reid Kroloff, one of those who helped advise the commission, as a planning exercise which would allow neighborhoods to reach their own conclusions about whether they're viable or not, described by others, including the former mayor, Mark Morial, whom we heard a moment ago, as a recipe for redlining and discriminating against some of the former residents, I should say current residents, many of them now displaced, of New Orleans. We want to take a bit of a different angle on this right now with Rich Campanella. He's a geographer and assistant director of environmental analysis at Tulane University, author of a book, Geographies of New Orleans, Urban Fabrics Before the Storm. Rich Campanella, welcome to you.
Thank you.
You have said that you have been supportive of this plan, that there's also a question of making certain concessions to nature. What do you mean by that?
We live in a extremely dynamic and young piece of geography down here. We are on a deltaic plain, and the former mayor was correct in saying that this is entirely a floodplain. At one time or another, every inch of southeastern Louisiana had flooded, and in fact, this landscape arose from sediments deposited by the Mississippi River flood. However, this does not mean that humans cannot live and thrive here. The city, the lower Mississippi, offers a fantastic geographical situation for a city nearly 300 years ago, but very challenging sites. And I think In being able to have a city like New Orleans in this very precarious environment, concessions have to be made. This is not a homogeneous region. As faint as the topography is here, there are very significant deviations. If you look at the New Orleans area and you map out the main driving variables that dictate livability versus danger, they are not evenly distributed. Certain areas are higher, 10 to 12 feet above sea level, closer to the river. Certain areas dip 10 to 15 feet below sea level, and they tend to be closer to the lake. If you look at distance to navigation canals, which served as pathways for the storm surge, again, certain areas are closer and more dangerous, others are farther. The same thing goes for distance to eroding wetlands, distance to the city core. Some neighborhoods are very far away and thus would compel municipal services and scarce resources and flood control infrastructure to be extended out a very long peninsula. So I think in one of the lessons from Katrina is that if we want to live and thrive in this complex, challenging landscape, concessions must be made. We need to map out those patterns of those driving variables, identify the most dangerous areas, and pull in our population to the safer areas.
Does that mean then, particularly with the population of the city likely to be half what it was, at least for the next couple of years or so, that the footprint of New Orleans ought to be made smaller?
Again, I would advocate mapping out these patterns and then determining that. I think it's fair to say that the answer to that question would be yes. Keep in mind, this city had its peak population in the early 1960s. We were over 600,000 people. At the time, most people lived west of the Industrial Canal then. This would be between the Mississippi River and Lake Pontchartrain, a much larger population in a small area. After Hurricane Betsy, we failed to learn the lessons of Betsy, and the city expanded into the low-lying areas of eastern New Orleans, and that's exactly the areas that flooded significantly with the storm surges, as well as areas to the west because of levee breaches. But with the 462,000 people that we had in pre-Katrina, that number is probably going to diminish. So I think it is wise to make these, to recognize these realities, make these concessions, and reconstitute the population in safer areas.
What does that mean in terms of the distribution of the population since Hurricane Betsy? And are you suggesting, as others have said, that the neighborhoods that ought not to be rebuilt are those which have been populated primarily by poor black people?
Actually, that is not quite true. The ethnic and racial geography of this city is quite complex. In many cities that are not in deltaic environments, you often see wealthier people living on higher areas and poorer people living on lower, more flood-prone areas. But this being a deltaic environment, we generally saw that pattern in historic times, although the very highest areas along the river tended to be occupied by poorer folks who tended to be longshoremen who needed to be right next to the port. When we installed the drainage system 100 years ago, This removed the standing water from the back swamp and opened up suburban development in the lowest-lying lakefront areas, pretty vulnerable. And what happened is we saw the middle-class white population living in higher areas sort of leapfrog over the poorer black populations in lower areas and move into the very lowest areas. And as time went on in the 20th century, we saw a movement of the middle-class black population into these lower 20th century subdivisions as well. So in absolute numbers, there's no question that African-Americans lived in homes that were flooded in greater numbers than the white population. About 220,000 blacks lived in homes that were flooded, as opposed to 57,000 whites who lived in homes that were flooded. Again, this is just for Orleans Parish. However, you have to account for the fact that the city was majority black in the first place. So when we account for that, we see that whites made up 28% of the pre-Katrina population and suffered 20% of the flooding, whereas African Americans made up 67% of the pre-Katrina population and suffered 76% of the flooding. So was there some disproportion? Yes. But the impacted area was actually fairly representative of the city's racial makeup.
So you're saying then that by putting the priority on those places that are safest, least dangerous perhaps is the best way to put it, that won't necessarily work a kind of a red lining, as Mayor Morial suggested earlier.
I don't think it would be a red lining at all.
Okay. Rich Campanella, once again, geographer and environmental analyst at Tulane University. Elizabeth English is associate professor of research at the Louisiana State University's Hurricane Center, studies, among other things, the effect of wind on buildings. She's also a structural engineer and an architect. And Professor English, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
What do you say to what we just heard from Rich Campanella in contrast to what Mayor Morial was saying?
I think there is a great deal of truth in what both of them were saying. Dr. Campanella brings forward the issues of appropriate environmental response, former Mayor Morial talks about the rights of the people to return to their own homes. There's another aspect of the history of New Orleans, which is one of the areas that I'm focusing on, which is that before World War II, most of the houses were built appropriately for the New Orleans environment. They were built raised up on piers off the ground so that when there was a little bit of flooding, a couple of feet of flooding, the house didn't even get wet inside. If there was more flooding, these houses were built so that they would flood. The waters come, the house floods, the waters go away, the house drains, the materials are mold and rot resistant, there's damage, but it's not catastrophic. The hubris of humankind attempts to control nature in ways that I personally believe are quite inappropriate, what has happened is that there's been a false sense of safety that has developed in regions that were developed post World War II, as Dr. Campanella spoke about, the change that I think is even more important is that inappropriate house forms were built. So since World War II, we've seen the construction of a great many houses built on slabs on grade, which means that instead of having having piers and building the house up off the ground, there's a concrete slab poured right on the ground, and then the house is built directly on the slab, so that any kind of flooding happens, and those houses get wet.
All right, let's flash forward, if I may, because we're short of time here, and what you've said is extremely interesting, to the proposal by the Rebuild New Orleans Commission. Does it offer an opportunity to do what I think you're suggesting, which is go back to a more appropriate form of construction? Or is it, as I think you have said in the past, a death sentence for poor neighborhoods? And why would that be so?
I think it's I have said that it's a death sentence for the poorer neighborhoods, and I think that is because the working class neighborhoods in New Orleans are. Particularly in the lower Ninth Ward, the area that I've focused my work on recently, has a large proportion of home ownership, but it's working class homeowners, and they may not have a whole lot of money in the bank. They may not have a whole lot of resources other than what's invested in their houses. Now,
do they have those inappropriate houses with slabs on grade that were burned?
No. Many of them are living in the traditional old shotgun houses built before World War II by their grandparents or great-grandparents. And so there have been several generations of some of these families living in the same house, in the same neighborhood. As the family grows, other family members buy the houses that become available in the neighborhood. And so there's a very, very tight sense of community that develops in these neighborhoods. And there's a very strong relationship between the house form itself and the way the people live in these houses and live in these neighborhoods. I don't think there's time to go into that in too much detail.
No, does the plan, the proposal that's been put forward, take that into consideration sufficiently, do you think? And are you suggesting that homes of an appropriate nature could be rebuilt in areas that appear to be among the more dangerous ones if you do it right?
Well, all it takes to make a shotgun safe is to jack it up and raise the height of the piers so that instead of being 2 feet off the ground, it might be 7 feet off the ground or higher if necessary.
I hear what you're saying. Again, Elizabeth English is an associate professor at Louisiana State, structural engineer and architect. I want to go back to Rich Campanella, our geographer. I'm interested in your take on what we're hearing from Elizabeth English.
I would definitely advocate returning to the construction typologies and technologies of the past that acknowledged that we do live in a floodplain here. And the reason why so many of these homes were built up on piers was because they were built before the drainage system was installed. And so people learned to, as we said before, make this concession.
Okay, the question I want to ask, though, is if you did it that way then, would it be unnecessary to, what you suggested earlier, reduce the footprint of the city?
Not quite, because some of these extremely low-lying areas out in eastern New Orleans, which incidentally is also in the Ninth Ward, but not the lower Ninth Ward, are so far below sea level that you would have to build, you'd have to put pilings that would be ridiculously and unreasonably high. You'd almost need an elevator mm-hmm. to get up to them. I'm talking neighborhoods at negative 12, maybe even negative 15 in some areas. So if you'd wanted to get above the base flood elevation, we're talking 20-foot high houses here. However, the lower Ninth Ward, technically speaking, is not as topographically low as many people think. It goes from about -4 up to about +8. And the reason is it's closer to the river than eastern New Orleans
okay.
subdivisions.
Let me go back to Reed DeKroloff, our first guest, Dean of Tulane University School of Architecture, advisor to the Commission on Rebuilding New Orleans. I'm just interested in your take on what we heard from Elizabeth English in particular about the death of neighborhoods and the possibility of rebuilding in the manner that she suggested. Is that something that is envisioned by the plan?
The plan at this point does not go into the specifics of how to build buildings because that would be at a later stage. I think Professor English is correct on the no slab on grade model. It's silly that anybody would ever build here a slab on grade. Just common sense would tell you that that's a poor decision about home building in a flood-prone area, even if those floods are moderate. I think Professor English's comment about death to moderate-income neighborhoods is incendiary and probably put out for media attention more than anything else because that's absolutely untrue. And I think Dr. Campanella is very good about pointing out that the lower Ninth Ward, for instance, which seems to be the focus of so much attention, particularly from critics like Mayor Morial, is a perfect example. If, in fact, that neighborhood is above sea level or reasonably above the floodplain as indicated by the new floodplain maps, and is not found to be covered in toxic material that can't be reclaimed, it's a perfect neighborhood for redevelopment and rebuilding. It's
okay, but let me go back to Professor English. Is your death to neighborhoods a comment, in fact, then, for media attention? Is it taking the emphasis away from what Reed Kurloff just suggested, which is that the lower Ninth Ward might be a perfect place to rebuild?
I'm delighted to hear that Reed's opinion that the hello Reed that the lower Ninth Ward could be rebuilt. One of my major concerns, though, is that on the plan that that was published, the particular neighborhood that I'm most involved in was slated to be turned into a park. And
what should it be?
I think the people who live in that neighborhood should be allowed to come back to their homes.
All right. Dean Kurloff, what about it? Would that neighborhood then necessarily be a park?
No, nothing has been slated to be turned into a park. What we suggested was that in addition to making better neighborhoods, the city, which has an inadequate park system, could have many more parks. And we were suggesting that if it was found that in that neighborhood there was a low-lying area that wasn't suitable for redevelopment, it would probably be wonderfully suitable for retention and park use.
All right, Professor English, does that make you feel better about it?
Does make me feel a little bit better, but I still think the plan is tantamount to a death sentence for some of these neighborhoods, because this goes back to the point that these working class people who come from these neighborhoods don't have a lot of resources. And there are plans I've been in contact with a mortgage company that wants to basically relieve their clients' mortgages and help them get back on their feet and loan them the money for home repairs.
How would the plan make that not feasible or not happen?
What mortgage company is going to invest $1.5 million in a neighborhood that, when they're being told that their clients are not allowed to go in and rebuild? In the meantime, the houses are continuing to deteriorate because FEMA has refused to put blue tarps on the roofs, so they're still exposed to the elements. The houses are
so this goes to the question of the moratorium, then. Is that what you're referring
yes.
to? Okay, Reed Kurloff, what about it? Your response to that?
First of all, Elizabeth is absolutely correct. FEMA needs to put blue tarps everywhere where they are necessary, and it's inexcusable that they haven't, except for those properties that have already been red tagged as just completely beyond repair, and it's a pretty small number relative to the – I mean, it's a very small number relative to the total.
All right. But let me go back to Elizabeth English. Ultimately, both the state and the federal government, FEMA, and perhaps even the Congress, as we heard from Mayor Morial, are going to get involved in this. Are you satisfied that there's not been nothing decided as yet, and that the you will have an opportunity to participate in the process?
No, because the longer these people are prevented from coming back to their neighborhoods, the harder it will be for them to come back and reestablish their neighborhood.
And Mr. Kurloff, the mayor has said he has misgivings about that moratorium idea. Is it absolutely necessary to the plan?
No, Joe Cannizzaro, who heads the planning segment of the commission, has already said that the plan can work without a moratorium. The moratorium is in play was suggested strictly as a device to protect homeowners. It has nothing to do with restricting anybody.
So do you buy that, Professor English? Protect them against a building in a place where they ought not to or can't get flood insurance once they do it?
I would be thrilled if they removed the idea of the moratorium from that plan. And also, I would be thrilled if they would turn on the electricity and bring in the water and the sewers so that people actually can get back into their houses and work on them. The other difficulty is, you see, the working class people can't come back to fix their houses because there's no housing, there's no place for them to live in New Orleans so that they can get jobs so that they can be in New Orleans to do the work on their houses.
Okay, on that point, that's the last point we have time for, Dean Kroloff. How can they do that? How can they, especially if they only have 4 months?
Well, first of all, the plan does not call for people to return in 4 months. The plan only calls for planning to go on during those 4 months where people will tell us whether they intend to return and whether we can evaluate their intention to return in neighborhoods to see if there is sufficient interest in those neighborhoods to make them viable. No one is being held back, and I agree with Elizabeth, there needs to be temporary housing now.
All right. Much to be discussed, much to be decided, much we hope to be rebuilt in New Orleans in days to come. We'll try to keep track of it. Thanks to all of you. Reed Kroloff, again, Dean of Tulane University School of Architecture, advisor to the Commission on Rebuilding New Orleans. Elizabeth English, associate professor, Louisiana State, structural engineer and architect. Rich Campanella, thanks to you as well, a geographer at Tulane University, and our earlier guest, Marc Morial, the former mayor of New Orleans, now president of the Urban League. Yesterday, California ordered emergency action to cover drug costs for 1 million elderly people shortchanged by the new Medicare prescription drug program. Illinois and 7 other states have done the same thing. What's happening to one of the president's most highly touted domestic programs? More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Orman Olney back with Popota's Notebook on To the Point. President Bush points to the new drug program as the biggest expansion in Medicare history. But in the past few weeks, it's come in for heavy criticism from both Democrats and Republicans all over the country. Once again, like California, 8 other states, including Illinois, have had to cover drug costs for a large number of people, many of them denied life-saving medications or charged exorbitant amounts because of problems in the program. James Furman is president of the National Council on Aging. His group is helping to sign up seniors for this program, and he has been supportive of it. James Furman, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
How serious is this problem?
Well, we hope that these glitches, and there clearly are some glitches in the transition, are temporary and they will be fixed soon. We've been assured that government officials are working day and night on resolving them, and so it is certainly our hope that the problems with verifying eligibility will be resolved quickly. On the other hand, we're glad to see that some states are stepping in, because clearly there are some people who need help, at least for the next couple of weeks, until these things get straightened out.
You're quoted in today's Los Angeles Times as saying, if these problems don't get fixed in 4 to 6 weeks, it's going to be very serious. That's not a lot of time.
Yes, but hopefully, as we said, there are really two issues. What's happened is that 7 million people who were on state programs, Medi-Cal and California Medicaid and other states, were transitioned to the federal benefit. We still believe in the long term the federal benefit is a stronger, more solid benefit of coverage, and won't be subject to all the cuts in Medicaid that are happening in states. The problem is that 7 million people had to be transitioned virtually overnight. So there are two issues. One is that all the computer glitches had to be transitioned so that everybody would know they had coverage. And the second issue was that these people had to be either select a plan, a specific plan, or be assigned to a plan. And because many people were randomly assigned, there is a need for them to continue to choose the right plan. So there's no question. But this, you know, this was part of the law that the Congress passed. Medicare administrators are just trying to implement it. And it is our belief that these particular issues can be resolved in the next 4 to 6 weeks, and certainly should be.
Talking to James Furman, president of the National Council on the Aging, a lot of people are saying that and have said since the beginning, since even before this plan was passed by the Congress and signed into effect by President Bush, that it was simply too complicated. Do you think that's possible?
Yes, I think the fact that we're now relying on consumers to make choices among plans is a complexity that hasn't been there before, and that will take time to shake out. The belief is that competition in the marketplace will lead to lower costs, that choice is good for consumers, but this is kind of, in some ways, the Big Bang theory of healthcare. Everything is happening at once, and so I think it takes a while to see whether all consumers are able to make informed choices. Our analysis of that is for virtually everybody, the Medicare Part D benefit is a good deal. It provides extra coverage. There's no question for 7 million, in addition to the Medicaid beneficiaries, or another 7 million low-income people who will have 95 to 100% of their drug covered if they sign up. So there is a lot of good here for a potential benefit. For the average consumer who is not low income, they will get at least $1,100 worth of benefits from the government on average. So there's a lot here, and certainly we at NCOA believe that every consumer should consider this options and see what's available. If you're eligible for the extra help, it's a no-brainer. You should absolutely sign up for it. But some of the challenges of rapidly instantly implementing a marketplace for healthcare plans are coming to the surface and will take some time to shake out.
We've just got a second left, but do you think that the issue of the fact that in the bill the government is not allowed to use its massive market power to help lower drugs, you said, or lower the cost of drugs, you said the competition is supposed to do that. Is that something that ought to be overlooked, or looked at once again? And do you think there will be a move in Congress to change the bill?
Well, yes, if there's not compelling evidence that competition is working and that is, in fact, driving down prices, we do believe that we should look again at the Secretary having authority to negotiate prices.
Thanks for being with us. We will see, of course, what the President says in the State of the Union and what's happened in the meantime. James Furman, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
President, National Council on Aging. Producers of To the Point, Katie Cooper, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Jonah King, Sharon Rembaum, Managing Producer Karen Radziner. Thanks to the John Coltrane family, our Technical Director John Patrick Costello. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.